Blog Talk Radio.
The odds of becoming a signed artist and having 3 number one albums? 1 in 100 million. The odds of going on to win 6 Grammy Awards? 1 in 1.4 million. The odds of this performer having a child diagnosed with autism? 1 in 110. I'm Toni Braxton, and I encourage you to learn the signs of autism at AutismSpeaks.org. Autism Speaks. It's time to listen. Brought to you by Autism Speaks and the Ad Council.
Good morning, and welcome to the second half of Saturday Mornings with Joy Keys. I'm your host, Joy Keys. I want to thank you so much for tuning in. You can follow me on Twitter.com/Joy Keys, and you can become a fan on Facebook. Just look up Saturday Mornings with Joy Keys. Also, send me an email. I would love to hear from you. My email address is SaturdaysWithJoyKeys@hotmail.com. Well, first I want to say thank you to all the listeners, close to 800,000 downloads of the podcast. Wow, could not have done that without your support. I hope that you have enjoyed the shows and learned and shared with friends and family. It's been an amazing ride for me, but I just wanted to say thank you so much. Today we're talking about drug addiction. What is it? Who's affected by it? Who's susceptible to it? Can it be treated? Who is a drug addict in terms of, is it children, adults, African-Americans, white, black, Puerto Rican, Asian? And we have some wonderful guests today. Susan Swanson, she's the Grants Project Officer for the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Service Administration's Addiction Technology Transfer Center. And she'll be on the line. And then also a photographer from Ottawa, Tony South, he did a book called Live Through This, where he told the story of a drug addict, Stephanie McDonald, and her struggle to get clean. Let's see who's on the line right now. Good morning.
Good morning. This is Susan Swanson.
Hi, Susan. Hi. Thanks for calling in.
Am I calling the wrong number or...?
No, you're calling. You're right on time. You're on air. We're live, and I just wanted to say
okay. Thanks
for calling in.
Sure. Thanks for asking.
So this is a really heavy subject. This brings up a lot of feelings, look away, shame, I don't want to talk about it, denial, not in my family, or pointing fingers. They're the ones doing it. They're the ones that have the problems. It's over there. Nothing's going on over here. So a lot of emotions. When you say drug addiction come up and the face of drug addiction. Let's start at the beginning. Hopefully Tony will be calling in shortly. He's a photographer who did the book. But let's start at the beginning. How do you know you're a drug addict? What is addiction? Can you give me a definition of what it means to be addicted?
Yes. Addiction is... The official definition is that addiction is a chronic, relapsing brain disease, and it initially starts with a voluntary behavior of, in this case, using drugs, but over time it progresses and becomes compulsive drug use. And you know, and part of the addictive behavior is we know that people continue to use drugs despite harmful consequences, despite disruption in their roles as brother, husband, wife, daughter, worker.
Mm-hmm.
It's important. I'm so glad you mentioned the shame, because this is such, unfortunately, what we have done to folks who have this chronic illness is we've stigmatized and marginalized as some kind of a freaky disease. And the fact is that there's so many people who everybody who's listening knows, who has some kind of compulsive either drug use or they're at risk for compulsive drug use or substance use. And what I want to emphasize is that we know it's a disease. We know it's a chronic illness. We know it changes when you voluntarily first use drugs. From there on out, it progresses to a compulsive a disease and illness, because brain imaging studies show that drugs impact on and change how the brain functions in certain areas such as judgment and decision making and learning and behavioral control. So
Let me just say, according to the there's a White House report that said in 2011 an estimated 22.5 million Americans aged 12 or older were current illicit drug users. 22.5 million Americans aged 12 or older. So that's a huge number of people using illicit drugs. Now, all those people using, they may or may not be addicted. So let's talk about who is susceptible to becoming an addict. Because everybody that tries drugs doesn't become an addict, correct?
Exactly. No, they do not. And it's hard. There's no one single factor that would tell you that this person will or will not become an addict. As with all diseases, you know, vulnerability differs from person to person. So there's no single factor. There are genetic factors that may play a role. There may be, you know, we know that people with mental disorders are more at greater risk for drug abuse. There are individual factors, again, such as genetics or age of first use, because the earlier you use, the more likely you will become addicted. There are environmental factors, home and family issues. You know, there are community issues. You know, do you live in a community where there's a lot of poverty and violence in the neighborhood? Are there after school activities? So, you know, there are lots of different factors that will point to, there are risk factors that will increase the likelihood you can become addicted, and then there are protective factors that will decrease that likelihood, such as high, you know, better self-esteem, learned social competency.
Have more supportive environments and things of that nature. Now, what about men versus women? Who is more susceptible, men versus women? Are there any studies about that?
You know, there are studies, and I can't tell you exactly. My experience in the field is that people are equally vulnerable. It depends upon a lot of these environmental factors and family and community factors and genetics.
So now let's talk about the issue where it's happening in the country. Like a lot of times on the news, when you see drug abuse in terms of like crack, it's in the urban areas. When you see prescription drugs, then maybe it's in suburban rural areas. What's been your experience of the types of addictions across the country, like alcohol, crack, heroin?
Different areas, you know, favor or, you know, use certain drugs more. In the coastal areas and along major highway corridors, you may find more heroin and cocaine. In the Midwest, you may find more, you know, manufactured like methamphetamine and those kinds of drugs. It's an equal opportunity destroyer. You know, there's a myth that it is only in poverty pockets or in the inner city, but it is all over. It is in all families, and it can happen to anybody. And that's I think really an important thing, that it can happen to anybody, and that there is no shame in when it happens.
So now when it happens, I mean, if you ask somebody, I mean, I have family members who are drug addicts. Just recently I had a young man on who wrote a memoir about his experience. His mother was a heroin addict, and he wrote a memoir about his experience growing up with her because basically she was his sole caretaker, and he wrote about how it affected him up until the age of 9, and unfortunately she died. And there's many other people who have siblings, aunts, uncles, so on and so forth. When you ask these people, you know, do they have a problem? I don't have a problem. What are you talking about? I remember I had an ex-boyfriend who was alcoholic. I don't even drink. You know, I don't have a problem if somebody drinks. But I was like, you know, this is a little too much. And they were like, oh, you're just being, you know, like conservative, blah, 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 blah. Because he said, well, I don't drink every day. But he would, like, binge on the weekend. So I mean, what is that about? I mean, that's a, really a denial on the addict's part. Does that come from the drugs manipulating their brain? Is that what is that? Where does that come from?
Yeah,
it's developed.
You know, we used to say in that addiction is the only disease you have that you don't know you have, because everybody denies that they're in, and a lot of that comes because of the alterations we see in the brain chemistry and the areas that it impacts, as like judgment and rational thinking and decision making. There's
right.
also a feeling, I think, in my experience in working with these individuals is also that there's a vested interest in keeping drinking, that it does something for them that they don't feel they can do for themselves or others. And so there's this both unconscious kind of denial because they don't think they have a problem, and also, you know, being at some level scared of saying, yes, I do have a problem, and I may have to give up this substance that has worked for me. Does that make sense? I don't know if that makes sense to you.
Oh, yeah, no, that makes sense. Now, the issues come that they have to increasingly use more of the drug. I wonder, is this across the board, to get the same type of high that they got in the beginning?
Oh, that's for drugs that you can become dependent upon. That's the case. Like, for instance, opiates and cocaine and a lot of the narcotics, the methamphetamines. That is the case where you have to use more and more because you develop a tolerance. And can I say, you asked about the types of drugs and stuff. One of our biggest problems in the United States today is prescription painkiller abuse.
Mm-hmm.
And this happens to everyone. And 73%, in our survey, 73% of the people who abuse, who non-medically use prescription painkillers, 73% get them from their family or friends. And it is a tremendous problem.
They don't even go to buy them.
Only a very small percentage. And so, I mean, you may have seen the commercial they were running on TV about, the new drug dealer, and it's the parents, because teenagers are going into their parents' medicine cabinets. I mean, this has been such a big deal that, people feel, studies show, people have studied it, and they feel that the increase in prescription narcotic overdoses have outnumbered traffic fatalities in the United States. It's a major concern, and it would be a preventable concern. It seems to be a preventable concern. So there's I just wonder, we think about the heroin, we think about the cocaine, the PCP, but we also have to think about what happens in our own homes and how what we do with those. You may get a legitimate prescription, and then what do you do with it when you're done? If there's any left over,
how do you dispose of it? Yeah,
right.
Let me try to reach out to Tony. He's calling from Ottawa, and something might have come up. I'm gonna try to give him a call.
Sure.
That's the photographer who did the book about the young lady and her struggle.
Still me.
Hi,
all right, well,
this is Tony. If you leave a message,
okay.
I'll get back to you as soon as I can.
All right, well, hopefully he'll call in, but if not, we're going to keep moving. So let's talk about how this is affecting the individual and the families. We talked about the brain, basically how it's damaging the brain and rewiring the brain. You've learned that through MRI studies. Also, I was reading about PET scans and things of that nature that see what's happening. So now talk to me about what's happening in the brain, like problems with the frontal lobe. Do you have any like specifics in terms of like depression and things like that, like the inability for the body to create its own endorphins and things because of constant use of certain drugs?
Right, and that's a problem because, I mean, just like we're talking, why don't people admit they have a problem? Why don't they just get help? You know, people who, for instance, have been using an opiate, whether it's a prescription painkiller or whether it's heroin, they have basically their own endorphin, their own natural pain-killing system has, you know, gone to sleep because they don't need to because they have this extra, you know, coming from the outside.
Mm-hmm.
And then we ask them to stop and go into withdrawal, and yet they don't have any, and their natural pain endorphin system has to kick up again and start working again. So it is a big problem, and that it does happen. It does change different systems, and it particularly in that case the endorphin system. And it takes a while for the brain to get back to normal because of all the alterations, different drugs. You know, the different drugs change some of the brain chemistry, and it's not as easy to once you stop using drugs. Doesn't mean that that automatically your brain will go back. Yeah.
So you talked about the.
Go ahead.
Go ahead.
I was going to say you also mentioned about the family. I didn't.
Let's talk about the families because, like I said, I had a young man. I did a Twitter chat the other day with him, and also I had him on online, and we talked in the beginning. I mentioned issues of shame, denial. As a child, he was affected. He was displaced. Didn't get a chance to really go to school on a regular basis, always trying to fit in, hard time developing relationships with other people. Sometimes they say that children from addicted homes have problems being overly responsible or under-responsible. Talk to us about how this affects children in addicted homes.
You pretty much covered, you know, I mean, our parents are earliest relationships, and when a person has a chronic illness, whatever that is, and can't function fully, and particularly in with we're talking about addiction, you know, children don't learn impulse control, they don't learn self concept, a good self esteem, they don't learn self control, they don't learn how to socialize with people who. Because people aren't socializing with them, they're high or they're asleep, and so it's very difficult for them. And a lot of times they do become over responsible, particularly if they're the older child, and they become parents at the age of I have seen a 4-year-old helping her mother get on the bus, so they become the parent very early on, and. You know, there's a lot of treatment out there and interventions out there for these individuals. There's a whole, self-help group called Adult Children of Alcoholics, which, you know, to help people get over some of the things we learned, like, you know, you don't talk about your feelings, you don't confront what's wrong, you don't, all those things that carry over into adulthood and make for dysfunctional relationships. There are places they can go to work through those issues and to learn how to be, you know, better relationship skills that they didn't learn with their parents.
I want to mention that you guys on your website, famhsa.gov, you have a treatment referral hotline, 1-800-662-HELP, which is 1-800-662-4357. Also, which I tweeted about, you have a treatment locator that people can find treatment in their area across the United States. And also, unfortunately, some of the problems that come up are suicide, and you have a suicide prevention lifeline, 1-800-273-TALK, 1-800-273-TALK. There are a lot of wonderful resources on the website. So in terms of economically, this impacts the families because lack of money if the person is using the money for the drugs, but also in terms of health care. Do you know any estimates about what it's costing this country to deal with the issue of substance abuse? Are we really dealing with it effectively? What could we be doing more to help people who have substance abuse?
Well, I don't have there are studies, you know, done and that talk about the cost. You know, the cost to society regarding policing, regarding courts, regarding jails, the cost to society regarding the loss of, you know, productive years for these people who are addicted and not, you know, being productive members of society. So there are a lot of different ways that this disease impacts the United States and the cost. I forgot what you asked.
Well,
what was the
I found
question?
Some. That's okay. The National Institute on Drug Abuse, they have estimated economic cost to society due to substance and addiction. The economic cost for illegal drugs, $181 billion a year. For alcohol, $185 billion.
Mm-hmm.
Tobacco, which is something we haven't really touched on today, $193, actually higher than the other ones, $193 billion a year estimated economic cost on society due to those addictions. That's a big one, smoking, and that's another one. People, now they're into this e-cigarettes, which
mm-hmm.
I was telling a friend of mine, that's not any better. You're still addicted. You're still puffing every, 20 minutes. You're up here putting this chemical into your body. So they say it's better, but it doesn't mean it's done. Like, I don't know. It's
right.
A struggle. But the other question was, what can we do? You're saying this is a chronic illness. And so how do we help the person? What can we do to help the person?
The issue is that, like you said, there were almost 22 million folks out there who have can be diagnosed as having a substance-related disorder. And what we know is only about 11% of those people get treatment. So there's a full 89% who we know have this problem and who are not seeking treatment. A large portion of that 89% is because they don't feel they have a problem and they don't need treatment. Smaller percentages that they thought they had a problem, but they didn't make the effort. So, one of the things that we're doing is trying to do some kind of early intervention. The other kind of astounding statistic is that it's estimated there's almost 60 million people out there who fall into the category of harmful use. So they're not they can't officially be diagnosed with substance abuse related disorder, but they're still in that category.
On the fringe.
Yeah.
of it, basically. Yeah.
Yeah. And so a lot of what we're focusing on is trying to get early identification and training healthcare professionals and social service workers to start looking at doing, very brief kinds of screening and trying to, identify folks that are either need treatment or at risk for needing treatment, and to begin to engage them, help them develop a strategy to reduce or eliminate their substance use, and then to refer them to appropriate services. Because the problem, it's this access issue. Why is it that only 11% are accessing treatment, and how can we motivate the others, 89%, to get to treatment? So that's one of the things. Go ahead.
I was going to say one of the problems is this issue of insurance and going back to the healthcare industry. In terms of like mental health, I mean, a lot of insurance plans have a limited number of visits that people can make to a counselor, a limited number of sessions they can, do in a certain period of time. And then if somebody who's a drug addict may or may not have a job, in most cases it may not because they're using scrambling to get the drugs. So then in terms of Medicaid programs, it's limited. It doesn't help them, like, to the fullest extent. I mean, don't people need to go maybe every week? What policies, what should we do as an individual to try to get policies changed to make it more accessible and more frequent for the user?
Well, we finally have parity, the Affordable Care Act, requires parity for treatment for mental health issues and substance use conditions as well, as well as physical. So you should be getting the same amount and the same, quality of care. We're hoping that there'll be maybe 6 million more people will access treatment in the next, under the Affordable Care Act. So I to lobby, just to make sure that your insurance company is providing what they are supposed to be providing under the law, as we move into 2014, and And then to lobby with your, you know, the biggest here, the biggest thing is, again, that stigma. The biggest thing is that this is seen as a separate failure of will or moral failure, and it is not a failure of will. It is a chronic illness. It has all the hallmarks of a disease and illness, and it needs to be treated.
But Susan, I mean, mm-hmm. I wake up in the morning, I don't say to myself, I'm going to go use drugs. Like the person in my family, they told me they used it and they thought they could just use it and nothing happened. Why would you even start to use it? Like, that's my question. You see people killing each other. You see people losing their homes, their families, their relationships. Why even start? I understand about, I guess, their setup, maybe their environment, and I understand that. So me, I could be potentially susceptible because of what happened in my family. I could have.
Right.
I'm susceptible to that because I saw that I was around it, but I chose not to. I just don't do any drugs. You know what I mean? So why would you start it knowing the possible consequences? Is it arrogance on our part? I mean, as a human, like, I can do this, even though millions of people do it and then they fall off the wayside. Where do we get this arrogance from?
Well, you know, I truly believe in my experience, and most of my direct service experience has been with heroin addicts and cocaine addicts.
Okay.
And my experience is that these individuals, they feel it can do something for them that they can't do for themselves, and that may be they may have some pain from a child abuse or unhappy childhood or parents who are addicted.
Right.
They may feel incompetent, and they take cocaine, and man, they feel competent. I had many individuals tell me that when they use heroin, they felt better about themselves and better about being with other people. So it was an effort to normalize. Survive. And, of course, it rewards you to some degree. But it is, we know it's a disease and we know it's an addiction when, despite all the adverse consequences that occur, the time and the money spent in you know, drug seeking and obtaining the drug, all of that. But it's not that these people are bad. Bad people. It's not that they are morally, they have a moral deficit. It is a fact that maybe they made a wrong decision. They woke up one morning and said, "I think I'll try it," and that was a voluntary act. And then the rest, then eventually it became compulsive because of brain changes.
Sure.
I just want to speak to those friends and family members that there is help available for them, and that they,
mm-hmm.
It's very difficult because there's a lot of pain. You talked about your experience. There's a lot of pain.
Yes.
And please, even there's no shame in it. And even if the addict or the person using drugs doesn't want help, they can seek help and get some peace of mind for themselves. So Al-Anon, Nir-Anon.
It is needed. Definitely needed. You definitely have to take care of yourself because you think you're not using a drug, you're not affected. Well, I'm not the drug user. But because of the drug user's behavior, depending on how close you are, in relation, I mean, if it's like a parent, that's extremely close, a caregiver, but you're still affected and you become vigilant. There's all different types of behaviors that you as the external person, you get affected and you may not realize it. It can wear on your spirit and also affect your relationships, your economic, your livelihood, all these things, even though you're not the user. And
absolutely.
You can be in denial about how it's affecting you. So that's true what Susan said. Please go get some help. I want to mention again the treatment referral hotline, 1-800-662-HELP. Again, 1-800-662-HELP. Also on samhsa.gov. Again, samhsa.gov. There's a treatment locator right on the right side of the screen there. So please reach out to that. And again, even if you're not the user, but you are affected by the user, or they're in your family and your community, you might want to go talk to somebody about what's going on in your life, because you may not realize it. Your actions and behaviors are a result of being around this addict. So
absolutely.
An addict for smoking, for drinking, for heroin, for coke, crack, whatever, it doesn't matter. It's still a person with addictive behavior. Thank you so much for coming on today.
Well, thank you for having me. I really appreciate it. Samson really appreciates it.
Oh, well, you guys are a wealth of resources on that website, just amazing. So I encourage everybody, again, to check them out. And I wish you a good Saturday, Susan. And I'm sorry about Tony. I'll have to find out what happened with him. But we had a great conversation anyway.
Right. Thank you so much. Take care.
Okay, have a great day. Okay, bye-bye.
You too. Bye-bye.
Thank you, everybody, for tuning in. Just got off the phone with Susan Swanson from SAMHSA, S-A-M-H-S-A, government program. Behavioral health is essential to health. It's the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration. They have a wonderful resource there, 1-800-662-HELP, treatment referral line. You can follow me at Joy Keys. You can become a fan on Facebook. If you follow me or become a fan, a lot of times I'm giving things away, so I encourage you to do so. You guys have a wonderful Saturday, and thank you so much for tuning in.
The odds of becoming a signed artist and having 3 number one albums? 1 in 100 million. The odds of going on to win 6 Grammy Awards? 1 in 1.4 million. The odds of this performer having a child diagnosed with autism? 1 in 110. I'm Toni Braxton, and I encourage you to learn the signs of autism at AutismSpeaks.org. Autism Speaks, it's time to listen. Brought to you by Autism Speaks and the Ad Council.